In the first month in London, Dubai in September 2015, I got 250,000 page views. I knew straight away I was onto something. We have $10 million in revenue last year. We'll do $12 million this year. And we have 100 employees with 12,000 square foot studios, all reinvested revenue. But I was down to my bare bones. Like, I had no cash. Like, I gave up a huge paying job.
You have to credit Dubai. You have to credit the canvas, the city, the people, the stories, and the brand. And, you know, we've literally just covered what's going on. I'm just grateful that I found a place and a home that I've been able to feel accepted.
What are, like, the key factors that really made it successful?
You have to...
Well, you're the man behind Love in Dubai, behind Augustus Media. And I don't want to usually to introduce the guest. I usually let the guest himself introduce. So I will leave the open spotlight to you.
Well, firstly, Hamid, thanks for having me on Dubai Catch. It's impressive what you're doing and the purpose of the show. I'm very much behind it, as is Love in Dubai. But yeah, I introduced myself as the founder and CEO of Augustus Media. We're a modern media company. We established ourselves in Dubai in 2015. We're now technically present in 11 countries across the Middle East and North Africa. And our mission is to become the modern media company of choice in that territory. We have 5 offices. We have 100 employees. We have Lovin in 22 cities. We also have business verticals, Smashy Business and Smashy Sports. You know, modern media to us is text, audio, and video. It's designing media beyond the sort of print, radio, and TV. And it's, at the moment, the device of choice is the phone, and obviously the smartphone, and obviously social media plays a role there, but not limited to that. So, you know, we do podcasts, we have Snapchat shows, we have newsletters, you know, Facebook was big, now Instagram is big, and all those things. And yeah, I think, you know, building a media company in an emerging market is fascinating. It's challenging, but it's really exciting. And, you know, we're 9 years in, and alhamdulillah, we've done well. We've established a brand. You know, people trust us. People want to work with us. And we navigated sort of, you know, the early stages of a business, but we've also navigated building media in digital in the region. And yeah, so far, so good.
I'm sure there's a lot of information that I would love to learn about Love in Dubai, and I'm sure the audience would love to. But let me just ask you questions about you. And first of all, Richard, you've been here 9 years?
I've been here since 2012. So
2012. Yeah. It's been 12 years so far. But where are you originally from?
I'm from Ireland. Ireland has the Republic and the North. So the Republic is the South. And in Ireland, we have Gaelic communities, Irish-speaking areas in little pockets of the coast. And I'm from one of these tiny little places. In English, it's called Old Parish. It's got like a few hundred people, even smaller. Asquelga, it's on Sean Fubble. And so I grew up almost speaking Gaelic in the home. And yeah, so I came from the rural farming community. And I studied in Dublin. I went to boarding school near Dublin, and I studied in university in Dublin. And then I started working in advertising quite soon after getting an economics and language degree, a German dual major. And then I was kind of wanting to get into creativity and commerce. So I found my way into outdoor advertising, studied a digital diploma in the evening in 2006, and then got into digital advertising right at the cusp of social media. And I just threw myself headfirst into social media. And then I ended up in London in what became the biggest social media agency in the world. I was early knocking on the door there when they started. And that started what is now almost a 20-year love affair with social media and the growth of it. And that created an opportunity for me to establish a social media department with a network agency in Dubai under WPP, one of the conglomerate media advertising groups in 2012. So that's how I ended up here.
What's your favorite part about living here in Dubai?
The favorite part about here is that it's zeitgeisty, bringing a German word in, but it's, you know, when I was in Dublin, Hamid, I wanted to find a city that was happening. And I loved art history, and I would read about Picasso, and I would read about these people. And, you know, the turn of the 20th century in Paris sounded interesting to me. You had Hemingway, you had Picasso, you had other people, right? Like, there was crossover and people there. And I just thought in Dublin it wasn't really happening. So I was in Dublin, in British media, you'd read all about media, art galleries, football, celebrities, culture. And I ended up in London in 2010, and I got a single speed bike, and I flew around the city. I had long hair, and I lived in Shoreditch. Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, I had hair. So as opposed to now, and I was kind of like, you know, it was 2 years before the Olympics, and I thought, this is going to be amazing. Like this, but what I found was a city that was built and it wasn't moving. You know, the tube was built, the city was built. And when cities are built, they move slower. And the energy is slower because it's almost sedated. It's almost like, yeah, it's fun, it's exciting, but it's not the swinging 60s, or it's not New York in the 60s or 70s. And I didn't feel that. I was there in my prime, in my 20s and 30s. I wasn't in a city that was in its prime. And when I landed in Dubai in 2012, I could feel it straight away. Like, straight away. It wasn't on my radar. And my bosses in London were like, don't go there. It's 2 million people. Like, they use, for listeners, I'm using my hands and blinkers. Like, they don't go there. Go to somewhere in Asia or whatever, even though this is technically Asia. But, like, go to somewhere that's big and wide. And when I got here, I was like, hang on. This is an emerging market. Like, this is really interesting. So it is zeitgeisty. It is happening. And, you know, over the years with Love in Dubai and what you do and what lots of people have written narratives about the city, do put phrases around it like melting pot of cultures, and do try and write the story. And I think we're all trying to write the story in many ways. But the beauty of it is that I don't think it's fully written yet. And I use the word written, but it doesn't have to be that media. It can be anything. Like, you know, great stories and great cities, things happen in a different way. It can be architecture, it can be art, it can be business, it can be industry, it can be many things. I think that's the beauty thing about here. And, you know, people who fall in love with this city feel that. They feel it when you take them out to different places. They go, oh, I get it. And, you know, almost from day one with Love in Dubai, we sort of, when journalists would come here and write for Western media and sort of be critical of the city, you know, these stereotypes, things of concrete jungle, blah, blah, blah. And we would like attack back because it's Love in Dubai and it's proud of here. And it's like, don't mess with our city sort of thing. And we would be like, this journalist doesn't have a clue. Like, you spend 72 hours here. How can you know? Like, do you know this? Do you know this? And whatever. And then after a while, we sort of stopped doing that. We stopped sort of like explaining ourselves to the West or whatever. And we're just like, let's just embrace it. Let's just write about the captains. Let's just write about the community stories. Let's just tell the story of the royal family. Let's just tell the story of the owner of the restaurant. And let's just tell the story of the influencers. So much so, the creators. And so much so that people are like, you know, stop making stupid people famous. And we were like, yeah, but these people are important in this community. And they're not stupid. And I think that was like, that's our way of doing it in our media. And that's why I like it. I love Dubai is a city that's happening, and there are many cities that are happening. There's many pockets of culture around the world that have something fresh about them. And, you know, if you listen to European media or Western media, there are places that are going through a phase, right? There's places that are going through a cultural period that's just interesting. And this is definitely one of those.
It's very interesting that they point out that a lot of different cities have their own pros and cons. And when it comes to Dubai, what I notice is it doesn't really discriminate much. When it comes to Love in Dubai, it's the same. No matter who you are, if you contribute to the community of Dubai, you'll showcase it. Now, coming to the short time that we have, I really want to go specific question about you managing Love in Dubai. So what is like your usual typical day? Let's say, what does Richard do on a typical day?
I get up around 5:30. I work out. I do triathlon, I have a coach, I have training peaks, I do running, swimming, cycling, or strength, and I usually train for a race, and then I get to the office at about 7:15, Casey, my sister, who's the head journalist on Love in Dubai, she's always in there at around 7, she's prepping the show, and she's working with another journalist, and we have two producers, so the show starts at about 8:30, I pass
Monday to Friday, right?
Monday to Friday, yeah. And it's a 40-minute show, 15 minutes of news, 15 minutes guests, runs over a little bit.
and we slice it up. It used to be live and now it's on demand, and it's got two podcast feeds, Love and Meets and Love and Dubai Show. And we're launching these in all the cities. We now have the Love and Baghdad Show. We have all these podcasts around the region. We have Love and Riyadh Show. We have Love and Saudi Show on Snapchat. And so I do my first round at that time. Then I go to my desk. I read a page of a book. I read a page of a book just for a bit of peace. And one page every day. At the moment, it's still the CEO Sheikh book of Isinus. And then, but that's my sort of desk book. And then, you know, I do audiobooks as well. And then I do emails from the night before. And I've already had an hour in the pool or running. So I've allowed that time to digest so I can kind of get back. And then by about 10 to 9, I go down, I meet the guests, I chat to the guests, I do a story on Instagram of who's on the show. The guests usually has their PR or their marketing person in the studio. I chat to them for 10 or 15 minutes. Then the rest of the Calvary have come into the office by about 9:10. I do my rounds. I say good morning out loud to Saguna, an enthusiastic commercial exec. So we always say good morning really loud. And then, just kind of do my rounds in the office. And then I go back up. I usually sometimes jump on the Smashy Business Show at 10 a.m. I host that when we don't have a journalist. And I do all my morning chats. I have lunch at 12. And then I do my afternoon meetings. So I usually try and get people to come to the office. I always book 2 p.m., 3 p.m., and 4 p.m. At 5 p.m., I have dinner. We have meal plan in our canteen.
So you stay there until like 5 or 6 p.m.?
I have dinner at 5, and then I go back to my desk and I do 2 or 3 hours work. And then I go home at about 7:30, 8 o'clock. I watch 30, 40 minutes of Arabic content, and I go to bed at about 8:30. I go up at 5. And I do this relentlessly. I work 6 days a week, and I read on Saturdays, or I do podcasts on Saturdays, why I'm here now.
Wow. Your life is sticking to a schedule that's basically very fixated, so you have less time. How do you juggle this now with you being married just recently? So how do you feel like you're going to juggle the family life that you potentially have and your work?
My wife Hamza is great. She understands, and she's also incredible, right? She has her own business. She works full-time still with a global company in a finance role, and she gets it. But also, Hamid, there's a phase of growth with Love in Dubai where it's like you were saying about all these pages, I need to turn this business into something bigger. So I took the whole team to the North Coast in Egypt last summer, to Sahel, and we had 80 people, and I gave a speech in a conference room, and I basically said, you know, we have to be a tribe and we have to do this, and we're going to, in the next 18 months, we're going to grow from 80 people to 120 people. So my role is going to change and your role is going to change. So I'm delegating more. And, you know, when people, my phone rings in Dubai a lot. It doesn't ring in Saudi, even though we've been in Saudi since 2017. But when people ring about posts, like say the media office over the years would ring me, and I kind of say, hey, can you speak to the journalist now? You know, because I need to delegate. I need to empower people. And journalists have been there 8 or 9 years and they're trained. We have our head of content now, Simon, who's got 18 years experience. But Rich from Love in Dubai still gets the call. So I'm trying to sort of detach a little bit. Not detach in that way, but I'm trying to sort of manage time a little bit more so I can have more of a family life and more of a family time as well and other things.
I feel that being a great leader is about creating other leaders that can take much of the things that you used to do. You're building them to shape them where they can make the decision themselves and be able to pursue and perform at your business while you focus on the, how we say, like the 80%, 20%. You focus on the high vision. That's what I see mostly with Love in Dubai. Now, coming to Dubai itself, you've been here since 2012. I'm sure you've seen the rapid growth, just like from what it was in 2012 to now 2024. Well, what's your thought?
Yeah, I think it's in phases. I mean, you've been here a lot longer than me, and you know, the people who've been, you know, I arrived here when I was 28, but there's lots of people who we interact with grew up in Dubai and are been here a lot longer. And, you know, when they get asked that question, they'll think of physical structures and the appearance of the city and the videos that we often post. And, you know, but I think of it in phases, in energies and in feelings. And I studied economics, so I feel the energy of the economic side of it, but also the type of almost clientele, the type of people that live here, and the type of things that are happening in the city. And I think there was sort of when I came in 2012 to 2014, 2015, there was a burst of energy. It overcome the recession. There was the Arab Spring. So the knock-on effect of the people moving here from 2012 to 2015 was, GDP growth in 2012 in UAE was very high single figures. Like, it was a real burst of energy. I know most companies were doing 10, 15, 20% growth in 2012, 2013, 2014. And that peaked with the property in 2015 or so. And then there was it wasn't a non-recorded recession, but it was stagnation. It was economic stagnation. It wasn't technically a recession. There weren't two quarters, but it was very flat. And oil prices were low. There was geopolitical stuff in the Gulf, and there was stuff like that happening. And that was sort of, that was a long period up until 2020. And the other reason why we didn't sort of talk, people were saying, oh, don't talk about it because it's a recession. No, it wasn't actually a recession. It's just American media weren't talking about it because they were on a flyer. Mm. The stocks were flying in 2018. And so there was no real talks of recession. So, but there was definitely a period of stagnation there in property, in oil and stuff like that. And people were questioning again. And then that led into the pandemic. And then after that, it's just burst out of the gates. And so we can look at the things that have burst out of the gates, like property and stuff like that. But the feeling of the culture and, the type of people that are moving here, the type of stimulated by stimulus, in terms of 10-year visas, in terms of planning to live here for a long time. The employees that we hire now in Love in Dubai are, we say third culture kids or whatever, but actually they're Gulf diaspora who are Arab diaspora who have bought houses, and their kids are 20, right? So they're now looking for vocation in Dubai and stuff like that. And that's happening now with English people and wider. So firstly, it's like, say, Lebanese or Egyptian, and then Philippines and Indian, right? But now it's other diaspora. They're buying houses. Like back then, I'm kind of going in tangents, but back then there were no real townhouses and there was no accessibility. And now everyone's buying houses and everyone's sort of like thinking longer term. And that makes you think long term. And we're changed from, I hate the term expat. I love the term immigrant. Like, mm-hmm. Irish people are immigrants everywhere they go. And I just love it. I embrace it. And going back to your question about the statement that you made about, being, I think, I don't think you used the word tolerant, but you said that it's there's not judgmental, or what was the word that you used? There's no discrimination. Exactly. Yeah. And there's two reasons for that, in my view, right? One is the Arabian hospitality, that tolerance thing isn't a PR stunt. It's actually in the Emirati culture, in the Saudi culture, in the Bundan culture. It's actually, and it's in Islam. It's open to other cultures. It's there. And the second part of it is, there's no pretenses around expat culture. Like, I spent some time in Hong Kong and Nairobi, and you can feel the discrimination.
Yes.
You go into a culture club. If you go into a club here, there's no real clubs here, right? Where you play bowls in Hong Kong, and when you go to these country clubs, there's definitely a them and us. And that was never in the Arab world. And I think that's really those two things of the innate, indigenous culture of Arabian hospitality, plus the lack of like expat-y thing, even though some cultures try and maintain it, it's just not welcomed to a degree. And so that sort of thing of that has allowed many people to sort of feel at home here as well.
Don't you think that the reason Dubai is successful as it is because the culture in itself, the people that are here, 90% of them just come from over 200 nationalities. And you have only 10% who's approximately locals, if you think about it. So when it comes to that, it's different than the other cities where majority are the people that are from there. So if it's Hong Kong, people are from Hong Kong. Singapore is Singaporeans. And if New York City, I mean, it's a big city. It's a lot of different nationalities, but they mostly call themselves New Yorkers. So they're there. So when it comes to Dubai, what's your thought on that?
Yeah, New York is a capitalist American city with American nationalism, American the flag, Wall Street, hot dogs, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's important for Dubai to have that Emirati culture and to retain that. I think if it was just a free-for-all, then there wouldn't be something special about it. You know, we had a show with the media office a few years ago called It's a Dubai Thing on Love in Dubai. And every month we would do a 10-minute episode based on the national day of that country that month, whether it's Australian, Indian, Philippines, right? And the whole and St. Patrick's Day for Ireland. The whole point was we're not at home in our own country, but we're at home here. And It's a Dubai Thing. We can celebrate our national day here with people from our country, but others. You know, I recently we've been doing Love in Doha in Qatar, and what I sort of realized is that in Qatar and in Emirates, Emiratis like yourself have a national anthem and have a flag and have a colour shirt, and but immigrants don't, right? So what tends to happen is they flock together. Like Irish people are famous for going to Irish pubs and playing their sport around the world, right? And they flock together around their restaurants and their communities. And where what's the special ingredients that Love in Dubai has is that we and the city have recognized that put everyone in the same place and use language that is accepting for everyone. So we're allowing the common denominator. So if there's 1.3 million followers or 3 or 4 million followers, if they sort of comment about one thing, you know, what I love about Love in Dubai and what I love about media and people here is that it's a mix. And what I think that what Western media did in Dubai before us is they had journalists from a certain country and they used a certain language. Do you know that most of the magazines here use British English? But the actual English, even though Arabic is on the constitution here, English is the English out of government material in the UAE is actually American English, and place names is American English. But journalists who were hired from the UK in the past, I'm not a journalist, they used British and they protected their own form of English, right? Journalists come in and they do what they want with us, but like basically we try and do English, American English. Because the Emirates does. But point being is that we recognize the different nationalities. There are 250,000 people from the UK here, same as South Africa, same for Lebanon, 3% of the country. If there's 10 million people here, in that respect, it's insignificant. So if you're writing about celebs you think are important, they're not. 600,000 Egyptians, 800,000 or 900,000 Philippines, right? Like in the Wikipedia and in the Lonely Planet and things, people always talk about subcontinent Asians in the UAE, but they miss the mix. And I think when you're doing that, and when you're writing for the 1 million Emiratis who grew up speaking English and not just writing for immigrants, when you recognize that melting pot as the city does, you're part of that tolerance and you're part of that acceptance. And then that helps shape the sort of common denominator of what we all sort of feel is important at the time.
Interesting. I see what you mean when it comes to how you're setting the style of the content, the style of the production of those content to match everyone who's actually living here, no matter their nationality. And the way that you're also associating that English, you're using the English according to what the country type of English that they're using, especially here. Now, going back to the subject of you coming back 2012, you came here 2012. Did you actually have the business ready, Love in Dubai, or is this something that just came up the moment you came
here? My job was a social media director.
All right.
With Mindshare, and I had to set up a social media department, and Mindshare had clients like Nissan Infinity, Ocean Refreshments, and clients like 300 clients all over the region.
So it was a social media agency?
They were a media buying agency. So they media buying in the past would buy the TV ads and the billboards, and they would pitch for government contracts. Like Dubai Tourism were a first client, like with a lady named Sally Edwards at DTCM. That my first meeting in Dubai in the first week of June 2012 was with Sally and the Dubai Tourism when it was under a different structure then. And they were setting up Dubai Calendar. And like it stems back to that. Like I remember doing social media listening reports for Sally and her team and seeing that people were tagging things. And then His Highness Sheikh Hamdan in January 2014 launched the My Dubai hashtag. And that kind of stemmed from all that like social media listening and all that sort of stuff. So back then I was doing social media work and I was trying to build it as a revenue stream for Mindshare. And because I could see that, you know, media was used to be about buying TV ads or making TV ads. So way back, if people watch Mad Men, way back you had creative agencies and then the media buying when it was more than a few print, radio and TV, when there was hundreds of print, hundreds of TV. And then they split out in different agencies. And the region had pioneers, had sort of Lebanese industry pioneers, like, you know, big famous names that have, some have sadly passed recently, and they built the industry across the region. You know, TBWA, RAD, you know, Memac, Ogilvy, you know, and JWT and all these different agencies. And sort of Mindshare evolved out of that. So international names with regional businessmen owned by people here. And that's sort of how it came. And I hired 30 trilingual graduates in Beirut. We built it up to 30 clients and, you know, all these different brands and stuff like that. And 2015, I remember I was going up and back to Beirut. I was working with clients in Iraq, in Kuwait, in Amman, in Cairo, all over. I was hardly in Dubai. I was on a plane. You know, I was in Riyadh a lot, Jeddah. And I remember my friend in Dublin had built Love in Dublin. And it was a blog. And I saw this thing happening on Facebook. And
was it like a blog search? But was it a blog that is actually in the website? Or
what? Yeah. Yeah, it was blogging style, but he'd done it in a way, you know, like a podcast now, like you're doing a podcast. Like the surge of podcasts at the moment remind me of blogging, like before Instagram. That's why I think what's happening on podcasts now is actually a TikTok thing. And you know, before Instagram, everyone had a blog. Like they had a daddy blog, they had a fashion blog, they had a food blog, like WordPress, blogger.com was bought by Google for a few hundred million. Like back then, it was all about SEO and Blogger and AdSense and stuff like that.
Is it still relevant as much as today?
No, there's no blogs now. Like Instagram became the blog. Like there's no real blog. And newsletters like Substack and became the blogs. But so he built a better blog, right? Just like there's a better podcast. Like someone who treats podcasts with better production, like what you're doing, you know, cuts through the masses. Like I think there's 3,000 or 4,000 podcasters in Dubai. 1,000 of them are under Podster on a, you know, unreported figures, but true. And I think they'll all fall away because really they're doing it for vanity clicks on TikTok. But the ones that will push through are like the Love in Dublin thing and like Love in Dubai. And Love in Dubai emerged as a media brand because we treated it like a media company. We got the media license and we built a website, we built an app and stuff like that. And I was looking for an opportunity. I was 32. And I was looking to run my own business. And I pitched myself as an MD to an ad tech, a technology company that had bot technology, like robot AI stuff back then. And I became MD. And I also, at the same time, with an NOC and with a separate license, set up Augustus Media in DMCC. So I was MD from Monday, back then, from Sunday to Thursday. And then I would go over at the weekend. I hired a journalist from ITP. And I hired a junior person. I put all my savings and a bit of cash from friends. And a year into Love in Dubai, we'd loads of page views because we were doing clickbait and we were growing the page views, but we'd no revenue. And I had to quit my job. I had to go in full time. I sold my bike. My bike actually crashed and I couldn't fix it. I didn't have a bike. I love cycling, triathlon, all that stuff. And I sold my car. I had a Nissan 370Z. Like, you know, I never drove until like moved to Dubai. I was like cycling bikes in Dublin and learned how to drive. I still can't drive an automatic, a manual. So I learned how to drive. In our country, normally it's manuals, but I learned how to drive an automatic. And I sold my little sports car and I didn't have anything. And then I started getting revenue with Love in Dubai after 18 months. And now
18 months as a whole, you were just working nonstop. How many hours are you investing every day just working with this?
Yeah, it was relentless. And it still is kind of, but it was relentless. Like I started in Astrolabs in DMCC on the first, we started 1st of September 2015. Mm-hmm. And then I joined on the 1st of May 2016. So I was doing it in the evenings and stuff. And I won social media clients, Nikhil Moles, Infinity Middle East, to pay the revenue. Like the Infinity Middle East contract was 50,000 dirhams a month. I hired two people that cost me about 35 to run it. That contract, and they didn't pay us for 4 months. Great client, and that's not their fault. It's just the payment terms. But that contract saved us, and we only did it for 18 months. But it took until end of 2016 to start getting restaurant revenue on Love in Dubai, like sponsored articles. Like, we invented this sponsored content unit that BuzzFeed were trying to do, but we did it at a local level. And that's why I believe that if you really persist with sponsored content model, like on podcasts, and you give value, you can really create a business model. And we did with Love in Dubai. And then 7 days, that tabloid newspaper shut down, and we bought their social assets, created a load of PR on that. And by June 2017, the same month, we did 23 articles on the 5th of June when the Qatar blockade happened. And we had a features writer, and we got, and then on the 29th of that month, we had a viral article because Rihanna was dating a well-known Saudi personality, and we got 2.9 million page views that month. So we were the biggest media in the country that year. We had 18 million page views in 2017, and quickly we got a million fans on Facebook. And then it started turning into revenue. And now we have $10 million in revenue last year. We'll do 12 million this year. And we have 100 employees with 12,000 square foot studios, all reinvested revenue. But I was down to my bare bones. Like, I had no cash. Like, I gave up a huge paying job. But that was the start of it.
So 18 months, how many employees you had?
Then?
Yeah.
On Love in Dubai, there was one and me. But like, I let the editor go, and I can't spell, and I became the editor. I worked like literally 14 hours a day.
So you're like a solopreneur at that time.
Yeah, ask the people from then at Astrolabs, ask Deliveroo, ask the different people that grew out of there at the time, and the guys who still run it. We have a kind of alumni, and I was literally like, they have a logo up on the wall, like, make it happen. I was there with my laptop. Like, and I didn't move. And, you know, when I went in front of them, I tried to pay for the extra desks, the fancy desks, the permanent desks. I couldn't afford them. They were 3,500 dirhams a month, and I had to go back down to the 2,000 dirham desks. Like, I literally couldn't afford anything. So I just went down to the bare bones, got my laptop, and literally published. Like, I didn't take breaks. I didn't do holidays. I still have the holiday tracker from then. The only time that I took a holiday is because my mum broke her hip. So I had to fly to Ireland to babysit her, basically, for a week, where our brothers and sisters took turns. And, like, that was in the middle. Like, I was still working from there. But no, I didn't take a break. And pretty much, like, up until now, like, it was, like, I literally didn't, like, you know.
But usually it was blogging the whole time. You were just writing articles. You weren't actually starting the social media part.
It was Facebook. It was clickbait. It was an article or a post every 40 minutes. I would go to meetings.
Every 40 minutes?
Yeah.
Just posting an article?
Yeah.
How many content would that be in a day?
10 to 15 posts a day. This is what was funny, right?
Interesting.
I was in Mindshare, and I asked the people selling, like buying, like spending, you know, we were doing like $100-150 million a year just with clients, right? Like, you would do media plans with a few hundred thousand dollars on them for Nissan, for HSBC, for all these clients. And I asked them, I was like, guys, what about like lifestyle content? And they're like, Rich, don't touch it. There's no, like, do music, do business, do something else. Like, it's saturated. I'm like, but is it? Like, and they're like, yeah, because you've got Stylist has just launched, Shortlist, Time Out. You've got all these things that have been around a long time. You've got all these publishing houses, Motivate, MediaQuest, ITP, don't touch it. And I'm like, yeah, but they're not doing digital. And they're like, yeah, but, you know, they will. And I'm like, yeah, but they're not doing it. Like, back then, Time Out were doing 10 posts a week. Like, even 7 days, even Gulf News and Khaleesh Times weren't doing digital, in my view. So we just went in and we just ripped it up. Like, we literally published in a native, fast way. They were doing 10 a week. We did 10 a day, and we didn't stop. And we passed them out in page views in a few months. So I knew, because I used to blog in London, right? I had a burrito dating blog, and I used to get 5,000 page views a month, right? With one post a week. In the first month at Love in Dubai in September 2015, I got 250,000 page views. I knew straight away I was onto something. You know when you open a restaurant or where you launch a social media thing, you know when the ingredients just work? It was the logo, it was the feel. Like, our first article that went viral was 23 reasons you need to visit Dubai once before you die, in that listicle BuzzFeed style. And it was just all the rage back then. And I'd go to meetings and people were like, oh, I've seen Love in Dubai pop up on my feed. And from day one, I knew it took a year and a half to generate cash. But it was that relentless attitude. Like, I used to go into the Astrolabs in JLT on a Friday at 2 o'clock, and someone would DM us, His Highness walking through a supermarket, and I would post about it, and it would just blow up because it would, you know, it would just go super viral.
So it'd basically be a repost for
They would send us the videos on DMs and things like that, yeah. And we would turn it into an article in a faster way than traditional media did it, you know?
So after, like, from Facebook, did you transition to opening your own website, or...?
No, I say it was on Facebook. We had our website. We had loveanddubai.com from day one.
Oh, right.
But we used Facebook as the way to get page views. So every post on Facebook was a link to the website. And so it was an article link with a clickbait title. So this restaurant in JLT is the best kebab and our best biryani in Dubai or whatever, right?
And when you were mentioning, like, this exact story, clickbait, and you were writing about this specific restaurant, were you getting actually paid by the restaurant to put the post, or are you still haven't got those sponsored full menu?
We never did reviews. We have a rule on Love in Dubai, and you can see on lovein.co/manifesto, we say companies, not communities, not companies. So we don't go out and do reviews, but I don't mean, like, when I say, like, this restaurant, I kind of mean that something viral, or there's a line outside or something like that. I don't mean that they have a new menu or they have a brunch. We always ask them to pay, like, we always say it's sponsored, but it's because we want to write about community things. Like, if you look at Love in Dubai today, the post going up, it's all about things happening in the city. It's all about things happening with drivers or animals or influencers or things like that. And if it's marketing, if there's a PR company paid 30,000 dirhams a month retainer to get coverage, I'm using inverted commas, to get coverage, you know, then we say that's a marketing thing, and that's to drive footfall and sales, therefore you have to pay. And like, we're quite strict on that, because if we put all of those things up on a website, we won't get readers. So what we try and do is engaging content, not marketing content.
So to summarize this, and if you were going to say, I mean, Love in Dubai in itself, it's huge. It's huge. I mean, everyone that I know, if I ask them what is Love in Dubai here in the city of Dubai, they pretty much know. What are, like, the key factors that really made it successful?
You have to credit Dubai. You have to credit the canvas, the city, the people, the stories, and the brand. And you know, we've literally just covered what's going on. I remember one journalist asked me to work from the UK for the summer, said there's nothing happening in Dubai, and I said there's a couple of million people on their phones, there is something happening. And, you know, we literally, going back to that point about 14 posts a day, it's because there's we never have editorial plans, we never plan. This is what I mean by ripping up the playbook. We don't go to print. We don't plan an article. We don't do International Burger Day. We literally, every morning, I walk by my at the desk at 7:50 every morning, and I ask Sandra, I say, what's the post? And she goes, still looking or whatever. Like, every day, every morning, our objective is to cover what you and your friends were WhatsApping each other through the night or on Snap. And we want to do that within the media guidelines to capture what's happening, the feeling, the sentiment in the city. So when we post something, people feel an emotion. People feel that, oh, Love in Dubai gets us. Love in Dubai knows what we're talking about, because they're saying it in our language and they're saying it in a relatable way. And we just embrace modern media. Like, we just literally embraced, we've broken down the rules. Like, we've literally changed the rules of headlines. We don't write for newspapers, which is why, you know, when journalists come in, I really don't like this thing of, like, trying to change them from print. Like, you have to embrace digital publishing. You have to embrace what you're doing now with podcasting, unconstrained media. Imagine if your next question was to me, Richard, tell me in 30 seconds, X. You know, like,
sounds very robotic.
It's like,
it's
the radio.
It's not genuine, if you think about it.
Yeah, it's like TV. It's like, you know, CNBC, like, for years, they have a 6-minute CEO interview. What can you say in 6 minutes, right? Like, and you get these, like, scripted PR stuff. So that's why podcasting is such a powerful medium, and that's why social media was, because you break the rules And then you create your own rules. And the beautiful thing about media is there are rules, but they evolve. Like, radio is a beautiful medium. And when you hear radio done well, like Chris Fade does it, like, he's so, so talented. But there's certain things that happen on radio. You know when you're listening to the radio and there's three people having a laugh and then having jokes, and then they start playing the song, but they keep talking, and you get excited because you know which song it is, but the lyrics haven't clicked in and the bit of music, but they play it. That's like when you're listening to a podcast and it's produced well at the start, right? But so this evolved over 100 years of radio, and the same techniques are going to happen now. And that's what we're doing, but we're relentless about it. Like, we're literally trying to do social media properly and trying to, like, respond to the changing algorithms.
Now, you told me that your employees, people, your colleagues that are with you, they usually go with the flow of whatever information source to produce the content on a daily basis. Back then, you were producing 10 content a day. Well, what about now? Is it like there's a specific number you're trying to target, or?
I think, you know, in terms of, like, we never say we do original posts, content, like, we curate posts, but we do about 10 pieces a day, but we do hundreds of posts a day. So it might be 10 pieces, but it might be many, many more posts. So we've, like, under a company, we have 240 social media accounts, right? Like Love in Dubai, like, all in, we have about 12 million followers across channels. Like, we've the biggest, people don't know this, but we've the biggest Snapchat shows in the region. We have a show called Mimul Qasr Social Media, which is the biggest show in Saudi Arabia and has been for 4 or 5 years. We have 7 shows on Snapchat, all in Arabic. We have Smashy Sports, which is basically a national broadcaster with the federations for UAE, basketball, futsal, volleyball, handball. Our cameras in the stadiums, we did 600 games last year. There's 8,000 registered users, all locals, watching this Arabic. We have Smashy Business. Like, we have all these different channels. So in any given day, like, we're pumping out tons of content.
Through those different channels, of course. It's just amazing how you're controlling so many channels. How do you get to manage all of them at the same time and ensure the quality is consistent
with all of them? We have a culture, like, our values are tenacity. You know, the harder you work today, the more rewarded tomorrow. Ingenuity, a little bit of genius in everyone. So it's about diversity and believing we all can think for ourselves. And then the third value is velocity, all about momentum. So we basically trust young people. You know, it's like if you have an academy for food or for fashion or for football, like, we trust young people. Like, we put 20, if it's a football team, we put 20-year-olds in the first team. I watched the football last night, and there was a 16-year-old playing for Spain. It's amazing, isn't it? Like, a 16-year-old, you know? It's incredible. He's had 50 games for Barcelona last year. But I love this, right? I love building teams. I love trusting people. And that's part of the sort of embracing and working with the media authorities and trying to say, well, look, this is what we're trying to do. Like, we, the Hamad bin Rashid School of Journalism in AUD, like, we're trying to provide jobs for these people. Like, we're trying to do it in this way. So that's how we do it. But also, like, over the years with social media, you know, my brain has had this capacity to deal with all this stuff. Like, when I started doing digital in 2007, I had to do affiliate banner ads, PPC, SEO, all this sort of stuff, like Coca-Cola social media profiles in 2007. Like, I had 15, 20 clients. When I was with Mindshare here, I had clients shouting at me all the time. Like, my brain had to deal with tons and tons of interactions every day. So I just got used to it.
So pretty much every experience that you got from your previous job helped you shape into what it is today.
Yeah. Like, 15 years of working with clients, demanding clients on social media, trained me to have the capacity to deal with huge amounts of noise and volume. My brain for social media just works really, really, really fast. It sounds like I'm flexing a bit, but basically, you know, it's like if you worked in a fast high-end restaurant for 15 years and you go open another one, you find it easy. You know, you find the pace of the restaurant easy. So I find that energy of the newsroom and the social media relatively easy. So if something's blowing up, if there's a huge thing going on, I don't get fazed by it because I've seen it many times before. not to say that there aren't things that surprise me or that I don't like, that I don't get emotions over, of course. Like, there are things that affect you, but you have the capacity to deal with it to some degree.
It's very interesting that you have more than 22 channels. How many channels in total? Let me see.
On social media?
Yeah.
There's 22 Love and Cities, but they all have like 5 or 6
social other media. Than Love and Cities, you have Smashy Business, Smashy Sports.
Yeah. Wait, we've 13 channels on Smashy. We've Smashy Crypto, Smashy Home, Smashy Styles, Smashy. Like, we're basically building Panar Media for horizontals by cities. Hamid, there's 4,671 cities in 22 Arab League countries. We're not going to be in every one of them, but maybe with AI we will. Like, our Love and App at the moment is 22 cities. We have 2 journalists in Gaza. We have 1 journalist in Baghdad. Love and Khartoum is huge, relatively. Love and Muscat's big. We have 1 journalist in Beirut, Dammam, Kuwait, everywhere. And so Smashy is Pan-Arab by vertical, Smashy Crypto, Smashy Drives. But we're focusing on Smashy Business, Smashy Sports. But over time, we will have podcasts for all them. We will have newsletters for all them. And we have about 240 social media channels. If you go on TikTok or any of these and you type in Smashy or you type in Lovin, you're going to see how big we are.
Definitely. I'm just like amazed by how many, like,
a billion video views a year.
A billion
video views a year, yeah. Wow. Well, actually more, but like, that's the top line figure. But Snap report, in Snapchat Discover section, it's reported as a top Snap view, and we had 6 billion top Snap views at the height of
it. 6 billion?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. I can't imagine that number, since 6 billion is a lot of number. Usually, like, with all those channels, I'm sure you have journalists in each one, you have employees working for each channel. How do you usually get that much funding? Is it like you pitch to investors, or is it something that you self-funded this whole thing?
$160,000 went in by 2017 and not a penny more. It's all reinvestment. Plus the shareholders get dividends. We have 40 journalists in, 40 employees, not just journalists, in Cairo. That's cost effective. But yeah, we reinvest. You know, we basically... we have our business targets. We've been growing at about 30% year over year. And, you know, last year we did $10 million gross revenue, about $7.8 million net, which at 20-25% EBITDA, 20% operating margin, means we're spending about $5.6 million a year. We'll spend about $7 million. Not quite. We'll do $9 million net this year, $12 million gross, and we'll do about $2.1 or $2.3 million dollars profit. So 2.1 minus 9, so it means we'll spend about $7 million on our team and everything this year. And what I love about that, if you have to raise money for media, we're basically building, like, we're building IP. So all these platforms and all these socials,
the asset, virtual assets,
they keep growing, and our tech keeps growing, and our developers in Cairo keep making savings. Like, we reduced our AWS costs for streaming those 600 UAE Emirates sports last year. We reduced our costs by 58% because we're trying to figure out streaming, because I know streaming will be huge. It's already going to be huge, but it'll only be good if you can make it profitable. And a lot of the, only Netflix are profitable. The other streaming companies are making losses still.
So you think, like, Disney Plus is making...
It is loss making. Like, Bob Iger, like, it is loss making. They'll soon turn it around, but you know, Angami is loss making.
Shahid,
NBC is profitable. NBC listed this year, and they haven't, like, they don't pay dividends, but NBC sort of reported together. Shahid's an interesting one. It's definitely loss making, in terms of, like, they, so Netflix spends $17 to $20 billion a year on content. Shahid spent $1 billion over 10 years, and they were quite, you know, actually I won't share that. But anyway, so the content investment. So the excellent thing that Shahid did and NBC did is that they built their own tech. They built 7 CDNs in Jordan and across the region. And that was a really smart move.
They also have their own shows and
originals.
It's all Arabic. So yeah. It's catered only to Arabic people.
It's Arabic, but they have subtitles. I watch them all. I watch them as much as I can. Like, it's an excellent service. And at the moment, they're pushing the esports stuff, which is great. But like what OSN did recently with Angami is they built their own tech. But OSN licensed HBO and they licensed their tech. And now they have their own tech. And that's key. You can license some software, but if you're paying US market prices for all the different OPEX stuff for streaming, you'll never make money. And Shahid will do, but like, look at the history of Pan-Arab media, right? Like since 1985, when NBC started in London, and when it came here, the satellite thingy, right? They used to get up to 90 million people. That show, that sort of 30-episode Ramadan piece at 7 p.m., that Pan-Arab...
Everyone's watching it.
90 million across 22 countries, like around 400 million people, but 90 million used to watch it, right? At the moment, there's only around 3-4 million people who subscribe to Shahid. They haven't released the Ramadan numbers, but and I'm just giving approximates, but there's only about 15 million subscribers to streaming services in the region right now. So 15-20 million max to 90-100 million is a big difference. So we haven't like, but they're all on TikTok as well. It doesn't mean we're just getting there, but like it means that streaming is still young here. I don't think 5G is in all the countries. It's not all over Iraq. It's not in parts of Egypt. So you can't basically not everyone has a smart TV. Everyone in UAE has a smart TV, but not everyone in the region has a smart TV. So the app flicking that we do now, people are still channel flicking, and it's a generational thing as well. So that, again, fascinating excitement of the future in media. There's so much to plan and to look forward to.
Coming to the last two questions that I have for you. What advice would you give to someone who would start their own media today?
Media?
Yeah. Not necessarily have to be Love in Dubai, but let's say if someone wants to start their own personal brand or want to start something for themselves in social media, what would that advice be?
Two things to media. There's media and there's mediums. Media, you need a lens. You need a viewpoint. You need to know, because if you don't have a viewpoint, you don't have an audience. And yours is Dubai. Dubai catches Dubai, and that's really good. And there's plenty of scope there. But others can be sport. It can be passion points, football. It can be gender, it can be ethnicity. You can have a female empowerment platform. I invested in Balqis for her in Saudi, which is creating content to empower Khaliji females to get into the workplace in Arabic. That's a platform. You know, we choose Dubai, and then we choose, like, Smashy, the tagline is for the driven, the dreamers, the doers. It's opposite to Lovin'. Lovin' is love and life, memes in the morning, fun, adulting, hard to get out of bed, when's the next holiday? Where Smashy's the opposite, motivational quotes in the morning. How do I become successful? How do I learn, right? So that's our lens. So you have to have a lens. Media is unlike people. People can change. People can watch a light show in the movies and they can learn a book and they can do a course and they can have family time. But a brand has to be consistent, whether it's a shoe brand, and media has to be consistent. And then medium has to be, where are you consuming the media? A medium used to be print, radio, TV. Now it's all forms. So you have to decide. We say we're text, audio, and video. So we have to be good at social media and we have to be good at podcasts. And so if you're building media, you go, what is your lens? Who are you talking to? How? And then where's your medium? And then you can talk about frequency. Are you on Dubai Catch? Are you doing your short verticals explaining the city on your Instagram and TikTok? And then these are longer form. So this is slow news. This is a 40-minute listen. And this is a drop. And you're going to do a teaser to this. And there's different formats. You know, on your feed at the moment, there's cuts from these shows. And there's also the pieces that you've done specifically for 60 seconds. So the frequency is different. So you have to consider these different things to do it. But there's loads of scope. Like, you know, you can start now. Like, I love when we opened in Egypt, people were like, oh, but Cairo Scene were there 10 years before you. And I'm kind of like, cool, but like when Washington Post launched 20 years after New York Times, or when New York Times launched 75 years after the British Times, did they think they were too late? So it's never too late. It's never too late to launch a new podcast.
It's never saturated.
It's never saturated. Of course it's not.
It's never too late to start, and it's never saturated.
If you're adding value, and it's never saturated, absolutely not. That's a good and a bad thing. The bad thing is because the internet is a hungry beast, and you have to keep feeding it. So every time you open up a page or a podcast, you have to feed it. And you have to feed it regularly with good content, either once a week with really good pieces or 14 times a day.
Final question. The Richard that was back in 2012 and the Richard now, 2024. What are you most proud of this person?
I'm not big on like self, you know, plotting or whatever. So, you know, I'm just grateful that I've found a place and a home that I've been able to feel accepted and I've been able to passionately do what I care about. Look, I'm just content. I'm just happy with where I am today. And I don't really need to grow. Like humans, we want to grow, but I obviously want to learn, but I'm quite content. If I'm doing the same thing I'm doing today in 10 years and 20 years and 30 years and 40 years in the same place, I'll be happy. So I'm proud of that. I'm proud that I've, went against what my bosses in London were saying. And I came here and I did my own thing. And in my way, I was proven right in my conviction. And I just stuck to my own sort of guns. And, and I'm proud of that, I guess.
So be brave and pursue the dreams that you're truly looking forward to achieve, for sure. Thank you very much, Richard. I really appreciate it. I think there's so many things that we have learned.
Thanks for preparing and thanks for hosting me on your show.
Absolutely. Thank you.